SatNet, and K2GJE versus NWB2EAV. A lot of ads.
Yeah, but resonance is defined as where the inductive and capacitive impedances are equal and opposite. Fine. And there's an infinite number, there's a locus of possibilities. For every capacitance and every frequency, there is an inductance. And the real criteria has to do with where you go for it. There's more practical concerns. You don't want the inductor to be huge. You know, it's like to get a balance between the inductor and the capacitor that you get inexpensive and rugged components. And that's kind of, that's not theoretical. In theory, you could have one picofarad, 10 Henrys as a resonant, or the other way around, you know, one picohenry and 10 farads, both of which are absurd. And they'll all resonate at the same point. What you want to do is scale it so you get reasonable components, and it's just the capacitive impedance is 1 over 2 pi FC, and the inductance is 2 pi FL. And you get the opposite sign, so they subtract in a parallel circuit.
Okay, you know, I'm just saying that playing devil's advocate, that there were probably some values where the actual impedance is lower than you would want at resonance. And getting back to that equation that I kept on talking about, I looked it up while some of you were talking, and the point is, though, that when you have the parallel circuit at resonance, the impedance of the parallel circuit is on the equation is 1 over 0. 1 over 0 does not mean infinite. 1 over 0 means undefined, which EAV was alluding to as a locus of points and such. So I understand the EAV attitude that you just plug in reasonable numbers and you deal with it. I'm just playing as devil's advocate of if there's some kind of spice simulation that you can use to get a rough estimate, given the values of where your circuit's trapped impedance will actually end up being.
The local dollar store often sells scientific calculators for a dollar. I'll get you one. It's my treat to do 2 pi FC.
Okay, but that's just going to give me the impedance of the capacitor, right?
Capacitive means is 1 over 2 pi FC. The inductance is 2 pi FL. And you subtract the two. At zero, you have, you know, if they're in series, you have, when they're equal at the same frequency, you have resonance.
Okay, I agree with you, but the problem is, as far as the equation is concerned, at parallel, you basically have, like I said before, an impedance of 1 over 0, which is not defined.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
The 1 over 0 comes from the fact that you're considering everything to be lossless. If the elements are lossy, and mainly the inductor, what I remember is that a parallel resonant circuit, when the inductor has some Q, when it hits parallel resonance, provided the Q is greater than 10, basically what you see at resonance looking into there is a resistance of Q times X sub L. In other words, the Q of the coil times the inductive reactance. In other words, it looks resistive. It looks like a high resistance is Q of the coil times the X sub L at the frequency of resonance. So it doesn't go to a complete open circuit, which would be if the components were ideal, perfect inductor, perfect capacitor, but because the coil has some losses at resonance, you see a high resistance. What I remember is Q of the coil times X sub L.
That gives me an idea, Roy.
Can't be AV?
You gave a rule of thumb of about 5. I think it's possible that you assume that your inductor has a Q of about 15 or 20, and when you do the numbers, the idea is that the residue resistance that comes from the Q, and remember, in a parallel circuit, it's a parallel resistance, not a series resistance. And maybe that's what that guide was, that you want to have about five times your transmission line impedance, and you choose your inductor and capacitance, keeping aware of the approximate Q of the coil, to size the components so that your leakage when you're at resonance is about five times the transmission line impedance.
Okay, that sounds like a good solution. What do you think, DJE? I'm using suffixes because we have two N's. So what do you think about that, DJE?
Two N's are better than one mic.
I agree. So, DJE, what's your assessment of this interesting suggestion that the Qs ultimately determine in the real world the resonance impedance of a trap?
K2GJE, don't deny that. The Q probably affects the impedance of that trap, and also the capacitor, based upon its construction, probably has some leakage. That also probably is going to affect the impedance of that trap. I guess without having lab equipment to actually find the Q of that coil, I don't think you could come up with an exact impedance. I mean, these homemade traps, they seem to work, so there's no denying you're probably way off deep or even 10 times the impedance of the feed line, but I don't know how, or I don't think any of us do, can come up knowing the...
What frequency are we talking about?
Being able to, or the leakage of the capacitor, to be able to come up with an exact impedance of that trap, over.
What frequency are we talking about?
DJE, did you hear EAV? He asked what frequency. I tend to think that this is more of a general academic question. It's independent of frequency, but if DJE wants to, tell me I'm wrong, please do.
K2GJE. No, it's just an academic question. It could be a 40... 80 meter dipole, it could be a 10, 20 meter dipole where you want to have two frequencies available with putting up one piece of wire with a trap over.
At those frequencies, you can count on the capacitor. Once you're above about 100, 150 megahertz, then capacitor starts showing weaknesses.
Okay, I recognize Wesley, but it sounded like there might be one or two other people who didn't quite get the push to talk and call the ID at the same synchronous. So if anyone else threw out their call sign and wanted to say something in addition to Wesley, can you try again? To AMV? Okay, what's your first name?
My name is Mark. Just have a comment on...
Okay, Mark, comment away.
Okay. Circuit analysis is the problem with people. So take an inductor, for example. You know, if you measure the Q, the inductor of a finite Q modeled as a series inductance. Now there's a... that might get things complicated, but there's a transformation from pure parallel, which transforms that series in a parallel resistance But it also slightly changes the value of the inductance when you do that transfer. Then you can have your parallel LC, a parallel resistor. And similarly, you can do the same thing with the capacitor. If there's finite Q with the capacitor modeled with a series of parallel capacitors, you can transform between lines, let's say the equivalent parallel resistor, and that would give you a ballpark on it. Now, let me just drop it for a second. You want to get a feel on, you know, modeling components, you can go to a capacitor site like AVX or whoever's around there, and typically they have models available. And, you know, those models are usually characterized way up in high frequency where they throw the stray values, but a lot of times you can extract out, you know, we're down in the low band, with vast experience of other people, you probably estimate the Q of a wire-wound inductor and numbers. But you can you can draw out the thing. You can buy simple circuit analysis, and then you can get a closed-form equation for them. That's not an issue. Or, if you cannot do that, you can download Kino, one of the Spice programs, and put the losses in there, and then you can do front sweep. You can measure and characterize the device. You can analyze the circuit you have once you characterize the components you're using.
Silly me, Roy. I thought this was simple.
Well, that's rule of thumb. But then they also wanted to know, how would you actually do it? I'm telling them how you can actually do it. Rule of thumb is probably good enough, you know, for what you need to do. But if you want to go the next step, then it will have to look a little further and consider the other circuit parameters that you're not when you're doing a rule of thumb.
KC2GS. Well, thanks a lot, Mark. WA2MAV. I really appreciate, there are always different levels of understanding things. There are everything is kind of like, unfortunately, an onion. You peel one, and then there's another layer, and you peel that, and there's another layer. So I appreciate, Mark, you letting us take a look one layer deeper, and I understand EAV, that keeping it simple is the best approach most of the time, and I hope that the GJE liked the answers and the responses that he got from that question.
Roy, can I be clear about one thing?
Certainly, yes.
Many is the time I have not had the luxury of keeping it simple. And that's why I love keeping it simple so much when I can get away with it.
Okay, well, yeah, when you got a job to do and you know that keeping it simple will get you to the results, then yes. If you're sitting here kind of meditating on your belly button and you sort of want to know as much as you can possibly before you get a nosebleed, it depends upon your reason for asking the question, I guess.
Well, when you're doing a steerable monopulse phased array antenna as a couple of gigs, yeah, it isn't simple. No, you have to play the game. You have to go through everything. All you need is, ain't it?
Okay, I understand the practical approach of electrical engineering is very much part of that the profession. I don't, you know, this is a technical bet where we don't pause to discuss the quantum mechanics and general relativity. So I don't mind getting a little bit of a nosebleed if no one else does. So if possible, we could get to one layer deeper each time we go over a subject. I'm thrilled to pieces to be able to be among the people doing that. Yes, Wesley.
Okay, I sent you the article with general rules for Peter's magic, and it also applied to anything that matters much. So there is a straightforward rule. They simply define as a process of making one impedance look like the other. And maximum power is transferred from the source load when the load resistance equals the internal resistance of the source. But interesting comment is that the article that I sent you is a plot of the load power versus load resistance reveals the magic load and the source impedances will achieve the maximum, and that was figure 2. Varying the load resistance on the source shows that the maximum power to the load is achieved by matching load and the source impedances. At this time, efficiency is only 50%. There is another line for the transmission line. A cable, which is also a transmission line, a cable becomes a transmission line when it has a length greater than lambda 8, that means 1/8 of lambda at the operating frequency. So let's say if we have a lambda equals 300 megahertz, that we come that the minimum length of the coaxial cable should be 27.5 inches. For that line to react as a transmission line. Then it shows an interesting graph for figure 6, transmission line have characteristic impedance Z0 that must match the load to ensure maximum power transfer and withstand the loss of standing waves. It also says about the loss on the length of the cable, but I'm not going to go deep to it in SWR defenses. So it is interesting you could study that. It shows also matching impedance of the antenna to the impedance of transmission line, and then impedance of transmission line must be matching impedance of the generator or the source, and all of those dependencies. So that's the transformer that is being used for it. At figure 11, it shows how we can use the coaxial cable and another piece of the coaxial cable to match the impedance. So let's say we have a piece of coaxial cable with 75 ohms, and some of us tend to use that because it's cheap and available, and then it is connected directly straightforward to 52 ohms. That's figure 11. So that's just for your attention. And to exchange.
Okay, Wes, and I'll put it up on my link page. At first I thought you were going to comment about Ed DJE's last interesting question that we've been discussing. This really isn't quite related to it. I mean, no, it's about impedance transformation, but it's not really about parallel resonances or anything like that. And actually, Andy, during one of Andy's corner about 3 months ago, did a discussion on how maximum energy transfer occurs when you have matched impedances between the source and the load, and probably also mentioned that a transmission line that's not 50 ohms can be used as a impedance transformation device. So he kind of touched on those things, but like I said, I thank you for introducing this. I will put it up on the link page.
So I assume that we have so many smart guys here, although I'm not used to 2 pi, 2 pi equals omega. So when we're talking 2 pi L, it's omega L. For easy calculation. But many people... So I was waiting until everybody beat all of the bushes, and then I was trying to get to the article, so it's not directly related. Everybody said what they have to say. But not many people can immediately connect that impedance matching is important everywhere, even in your low frequency amplifier and the speaker. So maximum power is delivered when the speaker impedance matches the output impedance of the power amplifier, while there is theoretically correct, it turns out that to be the best arrangement is for the power amplifier impedance to be less than the speaker impedance. The reason for this is the complex nature of the speaker and loss of mechanical response. So this is like the first letter in the alphabet for the ham radio operator to just know. And then there is the article comes from the speaker to the transmission line and to the antenna and to the transformer matching and the methods of doing so. I found it very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Like I said, I will include it as one of my links on my link page. I'll do that after I'm finished with this segment. I just wanted to make sure that the SK2DJE was happy with the discussion. Had any other comments or any other questions? Yes, Mark.
About, I guess, what, 6 months ago, I sent you those simulations of mine. Actually, I said last with the clock, you can probably see how the mine. I said that in an eighth of a wavelength, doesn't really act as a transmission line, but it certainly will look like a capacitor. You had a network on the code end, and you only had an eighth, less than an eighth wave of tape. You have to add some capacitor to the net model. So, like I said, if you can model these things, and I did send stuff, that was about 6 months ago, and first off, over the radio, it's very difficult to talk about equations and plots. So that sort of leads me out of the fray, but those simulations I sent you, with Ripple, basically, you have higher voltage points, lower voltage points, phasing the current and voltage, cut the line at 10 to 15. And that's all characterized in the Magic Smith chart. Everybody should really start, and then you really...
Okay, I remember those charts. I was looking forward. You said you were going to be continuing to work on some more charts. So some of the plots, the legends, were a little bit transposed, I recall. But they were very interesting, and I'm sad that you haven't generated any more. Send it to us. If you ever feel the need, please send me a copy. I'd be quite interested, and I'll post it on the link page as well. I think that's about it.
Well, it did continue, but I guess when you brought it up on the TechNet, does anybody have any comments? This and that, it was dead air, and it says, well, okay, I solved the problem, and I'll move on to something else. Hopefully in the near future, I wrote an article on the complex exponential, because I got back into modulation theory and simulating that kind of stuff. But maybe if it gets published in the IEEE Pulse, I'll send you a link to it. They don't accept it, maybe on paper, but once again, that might be out of the realm of what an A.
Well, I would certainly like to see it, so if you could send me a copy, I would appreciate it. You have to understand sometimes that people are not always primed to respond on net. Some people are listeners. Some people are listeners until an hour into the net. So very often I will ask questions or comments or what have you, and I will hear the chirping of little birds. Doesn't mean that everyone is either bored or indifferent or confused by the subject. It might very well just be that the guys who might have something to say weren't near the microphone or were, you know, their mind was elsewhere.
Yeah, okay, understood. All right, well, if complex exponential, basically what I did on that one was I showed in three dimensions what a complex exponential was, and then projections on the real and imaginary axis, that's your I and Q waveform, and I progress to that basically any periodic waveform can be made as an infinite sum of those complex exponentials with complex coefficient, that's complex Fourier series. Euler's relationship between the complex exponentials and sine and cosine were expressed, everybody knows the formula for cosine and sine expressed in concept complex exponentials, and I actually simulated that on octave again, so you can actually see how the components add and subtract to give you the waveform. So makes it into the next pulse. I'll give you the link to the pulse. If it doesn't, then maybe I'll send you the paper.
Okay, very good. Is the pulse open access, or do you need to be a member of the IEEE to read it?
You can get it. I think it's IEEE.li. I think that, I forget what the, but if you can just access it and download stuff. Ed has his papers. I don't think it was in the Pulse, but I think there's like an archive, documents and the papers in there. But go up to the, I think it's IEEE.li. What I'll try to do is get the link for you and pass it along. And there's usually nothing in the Pulse. It's just a lot of advertisements because they can't get anyone to write. So last year, they had a couple of people write in an article. So I retired, a guy back at work, he's been bugging me to write something, so they had some content in there. But I can give you a link to that website.
Okay, I would appreciate that. Euler's number is probably my favorite transcendental number. You know, some people love pi, but I think too many people love pi. So Euler's number is my favorite one.
Well, it's really the basis of everything. It solves differential equations, antenna array simulations, it's everywhere. Now, you really need a fundamental understanding of a complex exponential to do anything in electrical engineering.
Agreed, and it pops up in a lot of other things as well. Euler, what was it, the 1800s, the 1700s? I forget exactly when Euler derived that number.
That I don't know. I guess I'm a user more than a historian.
Okay, whatever. I like to kind of get a general sense and feeling of how some of these things were wrought. We take them all for granted. You know, things like pi, unfortunately, are lost in the mist of ancient history. So there's no way to figure out who came up with pi first. Different empires will take the credit for it, but we'll never know for sure. But Euler's number, we pretty much know who came up with Euler's number, fortunately.
Yeah, that's even in signal processing, it affects everything. And how does it affect everybody? All your digital modulations, that's used today, DMR, P25, go deep enough in the modulator, playing with a complex exponential. Yes, so the website for the IEEE Long Island section is IEEE.li. And if you go to that front page in the upper left of Pulse of Long Island, and like I said, there's not too many technical articles in there, but you can poke around the site. Anybody can access it.
Okay, very good, Mark. I really appreciate that. I'm going to go to my web browser after the NEST and take a long look around and see what I can see. So I appreciate your insight into these questions and your participation tonight, and I hope you continue. Ed, the K2GJE, once again, any comments or any further questions?
Conviction.
Yeah, Wesley, you recognize? I'll get to you right after I find out if Ed's done or not. I'll try again. K2GJE, Ed, are you out there? Oh, well. Well, I guess he had to step away. So, Wesley, what would you like to say?
I have a question to Dr. Jeff, if he's here. Is he I gave him a headache. I have right now only one HP3586, the B version, and the Wandel and Golderman, the PSM-139, and I have a great fun with them. He's working on the other one. I wanted to find out what is his progress with us.
Okay, I didn't see any sign of him. Usually he will sign in on the chat room, but he might simply not be near a computer. So, Jeff, AT2PL, if you're out there, you want to hit the push-to-talk button? Well, Wesley, I don't think he's here with us tonight.
Yeah, I have a great fun with them. They are not only extremely good receivers, all of the measurements that could be done with it. And what he has is, he has a voltage regulator where one chip is broken, and then there is an interesting dial that was made in the 80s for the selective level meter 3586B. It has a light bulb inside. So I believe there was just the beginning at that time of digital technology. Hewlett Packard wanted to make the dial with the frequency change at some way. So what they did is they put the light bulb there. A small, tiny 5-volt light bulb there, instead of like it was before they had a chopper. So in some instrument of, I'm not sure how you're familiar with the technology, but in some other older instruments of HP, they had a motor that was at constant speed and some sort of the chopper. And then you had a light that was chopping by the plates of that motor turning around, and that's how you made a certain frequency of reference, and then that frequency of reference was used to change the value. But anyhow, that drive, because he's got this device for me. I don't know how I had a chance to meet him. He was at my house. Great guy. Absolutely amazing. And to exchange.
Yes, indeed. Jeff's a good guy, a smart guy, PhD, works in chemistry research. He kind of, it's kind of like a mirror image, because I started in chemistry and ended up in medicine. I don't know exactly how he worked his way into chemistry from his undergraduate years, but he's a smart guy. Does a lot of Aries, I believe, and other such things. So it's in good hands. I hope he enjoys it. I hope he has the opportunity to come back. He frequently comes to the technical mess. There are some nights that he doesn't, but hopefully he'll be back soon, and maybe he can tell us what he did with his new toy.
No, I'm not going to say too much about it because not many people are interested with it. But the 3586B is a selective level meter, like a voltmeter, but it does have a single sideband and CW. Because of PF, right? But it you can do so many measurements, and it could be considered as the early version of mix between a signal analyzer and vector network analyzer.
Yeah, it's now no longer $70,000. It's affordable. But it does have one thing that none of our radio transceivers have. It has 10 kilo ohm, 50 picofarad input. It does have many others. It has 75 ohms, 124 ohms, 135 ohms, bridge and 600 ohms. I wonder how would that work if I connect it to a 600 ohm transmission line of an antenna, or 300 ohms, yeah. But being able, the first words of Jeff when he got to my place was, oh, it has 10 kilo ohm input. I can connect it to anywhere. No worry any longer. Enter Xia.
Okay, very good. Wouldn't it be more across between a scalar network analyzer than a vector network analyzer? Because I'm not quite sure, but does it do any vector analysis?
Yes and no. That means if you have just 3586B, that should be a generator 3357, I believe, B for it. And it's a separate box. Then you have a tracking generator. Then yes, you can. In comparison, Wandel and Gottelman PSM-139, which was also about $70,000, but I was lucky to get it for... It came from Hong Kong. So altogether it was like a $700 and change. We've sending it to me. This one is much smaller. It has both things together. So it does have the receiver, and it does have a tracking generator into it. And it can on that, it is also like a late 90s or early 2000s, but it does have on the screen ability to some primitive a graph to be built. So you can actually measure the filters. And yes, you can do some of the stuff with the phase measurement and relation. So that would actually be considered. The good thing about it is, let me drop. Having vector network analyzer, you have to have a dead circuit connected to nowhere. You cannot have any voltage on it unless at certain circumstances you can do some measurements of the amplifier. But this thing could be used in life. This thing is not afraid of the signal. This it's kind of a signal analyzer with some functions of vector network analyzer. I have it only for what is it? 1 week altogether. Since last week when he spoke, I just got it. So, maybe 2 weeks. Yeah. But it's extremely interesting piece of equipment. So, remember when we had the discussion, when I asked you, what is the propagation like on 3.5 megahertz and the HF bands? Now I can hear it, and I can connect different kind of antennas. I don't have many antennas for that, but the greatest thing, the most expensive receiver ham radio amateur could have for little money spent. Enter Xia.
Okay, very good, Wes. You're getting a pleasure out of it. That's the point of this hobby. You know, back in the old days, buying it brand new would probably bankrupt most of us. But these are different times, and I hope you enjoy yours. I certainly hope Jeff enjoys his. And you might consider, I see that you haven't done a YouTube in, I think, over a year. So maybe you want to show off your new kit on a YouTube. That might be interesting to see.
Which one are you talking about? I didn't hear that.
No, I'm saying you, I don't think you've done a new use about a year that you might want to consider showing off your new toy on a YouTube video. It might be interesting.
Oh, yeah, well, the problem is, of mine is exactly that one that KC2WGB had when a bit older, just a little older. The amount of accumulated equipment grows up faster and faster, which is good for some people because they are constant constant stimulation of the brain, which you are the doctor for it. Actually makes helps with some of the brain deterioration because you always always active in it. But yes, I have a plan of it. I don't even know how many of different devices I acquired during this 1 year. Some definitely. I wasn't really trying to be. Everything for that, I put a very nice cameras, I learned film equipment and photography. It's really fascinating how ham radio could expand if you have a direction on it. You know what I'm saying. And to exceed.
Well, I often tell people that the thing that I particularly like about this hobby is the depth and breadth of it. There are so many different aspects, all the way from low frequency to microwave, from QRP to moon bounce, digital, and I can go on and on and on and fill up the rest of the time that Kapoor needs to do the Space Night Report, but I won't. It's only limited by pretty much your motivation, your energy, and your curiosity. So, you know, I'm glad you're expanding your horizons. I hope I am expanding mine, and I hope many people out there who listen and participate join us on that trip and do their own exploration as well.
I have a question to you as a doctor. I mean, you as a doctor. Ask to the doctor, right. We have a different people that have been many years in different jobs and they got older. Some of those people got stuck on one type of job and not always not necessarily related to their educational field. And some of them, at age 40, 45, they forget most of that what they've learned from the school, and they just getting older, they're doing what is required from them, and then when they retire, they lost their potential a lot. Some other people actually got hobby and became very good in that hobby. And that hobby actually pushed them to some side areas of science and technology to know it. But then, if you look at the ham radio amateurs, do you see that most of those people keep a good technical skills or even theoretical skills just because, and it helps them to keep their brain not deteriorating with age because of that. And to exit.
AC2GS. Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I think, unfortunately, it depends on the individual. I have had wonderful experiences on this repeater and elsewhere talking to very smart people who have learned a great deal and continue to learn even more as time goes on. I have also, unfortunately, spoken to a few closed-minded first people that kind of forgot everything that they were taught when they got their license. It could be back in the 50s, and they knew nothing, unfortunately. Because you spend time doing something doesn't necessarily mean you learn anything. It's a shame when that happens, but it happens. It happens to some people. So there's a broad range. There are guys who know everything about this hobby, who have gone through every nook and cranny there is, and there are other guys who just see it as a means to an end of chatting with a friend about the delicatessen that closed 35 years ago on the corner of what's it and whoever. And, you know, if it makes them happy, that's great. You don't have to be into the technology. I've talked with people who just kind of tell me, look, I understand you run a tech net. I don't really care about the technology. As long as the radio works and I use it, I'm fine with that. So, you know, whatever floats one's boat. I think it's different for everyone. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people who want to stretch. This is a great hobby to stretch. I don't understand quite how you can stretch too much if you're into coin collecting or stamp collecting. Some hobbies don't really lend themselves to stretching their concepts of technology in the world, what have you. But again, if it makes people happy, then collect those stamps.
When are we going to have next Hamfest? Like a month, usually, right? Like a month from now?
Yeah, I would assume, and I'm sure there are people out there who know the exact date, but I would assume it's something like the beginning of October. So if there's anyone out there who knows the exact date, please feel free. Oh, well, no comments. We can all look it up on the webpage, but I'm assuming it's going to be something like the beginning of October.
I must have doubled. WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
They're shifting it to November. They gave the date, but now I forgot the date. But it has shifted to November due to other things that are going on, different conflicts. But that's the latest I heard. Back to you.
Okay, so I guess November then.
Okay, Davidson. Are you going to be at the Hamfest?
Well, not 100% sure, but hopefully yes.
Okay. Do we going to have a pleasure of having a space guy on the Hamfest?
I would love to go. As long as it doesn't conflict with anything, no problem. Like last one, definitely conflicted with a certain date that I had planned. They're very good to go to. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I keep you on your words, both of you guys. Yeah, I know that I'm boring in the car, Dr. Roy, but I try to be more interesting this time, and to actually.
I try to make the field days when COVID hit last year.
Yeah, I've been taking a vacation from Hamfest for a while, but it's probably time to go back there. And I would love to meet you, Paul. It's one of my sad remembrances that I never actually got to meet Dick or John. Two guys that I think a lot about, but I never got to meet them. It's interesting how this hobby can make friends of people that you've never met.
Oh, yeah, I know. Dick always made a habit of showing up to the field day. Along with Eric. Eric would always show up as well. That was great. Back to you.
Okay, so hopefully we'll all get together. I've talked to a couple of people on the repeater who say, I never met you, and when am I going to meet you? So that will be an opportunity to meet us all. So we'll pencil it in for sometime in November. Let me thank you, Wes, for participating tonight. It's already 10:24. I just want to remind people very quickly that if you want to ask me any questions, if you have mailbag questions for the TechNet, if you have puzzles that you want to share, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, it's mailbag at ac2gs. Again, mailbag at ac2gs.com. The link page has a lot of interesting articles, so please avail yourself of them. I've just put up Wesley's article on there. That's available by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, I stream the audio of the repeater 24/7, so just type in technet.ac2gs.com, and you can live Glen Oaks to your heart's content. And remember Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of all the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. That website is amateurradio.tv. And now is time for the SpaceNet report with a full WS2N.
Okay, very good, Roy. And once in a while I hear the repeater quit. So if I'm having a problem, just let me know, Roy, you know, as I go along here. There's been not as many flights lately. SpaceX has slowed down. They would have a flight, you know, like three times a month worldwide. They've slowed down a little bit. India had a problem with the launch recently and could not get their satellites into orbit. I think they're going to slow down until they correct their problems. There's always new companies coming up, and one in particular I've been following for quite a few years is this Firefly. This could be called Firefly Space. The owners got into financial problems years ago, and it looked like that was going to go down the drain. But then along came another couple of rich guys, one guy from Europe and another American, and they teamed up. And they bought up the assets of Firefly. They changed the name to they kept the name, you know, Firefly. They just called it a Firefly Aerospace. And it's been in that, for, you know, under that control for the last, last 4 years or so. And they continued on, and they built it up, and they sure got the rocket to the launch pad last week. Last Thursday, they had a scheduled launch at 9 p.m. With this Firefly rocket. It's about 100 feet tall. They have four engines, they call them reefer engines that they manufacture. This is a rocket itself, two-stage rocket, and a second stage with something called a lightning engine. Anyway, it runs on RP-1 fuel, which is, you know, the standard kerosene that a lot of companies run. Filtered kerosene, similar to what you would put into a jet airplane, and liquid oxygen. And the idea of this rocket is to bring down the cost. It's all carbon composite instead of an aluminum frame. For instance, a standard flight by SpaceX with their Falcon rocket is $62 million. And these people are claiming they could do it for $12 million. Okay, it's not reusable, but it's very inexpensive. So they got it out to California coast. We have Vandenberg Air Force Base out there. And now they changed their name to Vandenberg Space Force. Don't know why they did that, but they did. And launch pads out in Vandenberg, and the idea was to launch this thing. They plan that it was their first launch, so they wanted to be safe, and usually they launch directly south, and you know, it'll go, you know, possibly near LA or something if it went off course. They didn't want to take any chances, so they just went, you know, toward Hawaii, which is a retrograde orbit. They didn't care, they just wanted to get it to orbit. Yes, you know, you do have to put a little bit more power into it to do that because of the spin of the Earth. But they feel they had enough power to do that. But it was interesting because, you know, most companies, they get to the launch pad on their first attempt and they don't even get off the launch pad. You know, if something goes wrong, it explodes, or you know, they have electronic problems. They can't communicate with the rocket. They'll stop, you know, they'll just abort. That's usually where they get to. Not this company. I mean, they've been really going full blast. They wanted to get, you know, watch it, and yes, right, they got down to zero at 9 o'clock at night, and by the way, 9 o'clock Eastern time, it was still light in California, and they got down to 1 second, and sure enough, they called it abort. Some kind of a, they thought there was some kind of a fire or electronic, you know, electronic problem, and they called it, but they said, you know, let's stay at it, and sure enough, they reset, and 1 hour later, they give it another try. And sure enough, they got off the pad. I mean, it went up beautifully. That, you know, I watched it live, by the way, on a YouTube channel. And they got off the pad, and they started going downrange in this retrograde orbit. So in case something blew up, they wouldn't kill anybody. And it got up to around 2 minutes or so. And they did say it was underperforming a little bit, the engine. They were not going as fast as they would like that. A little earlier, they should have gotten to Mach 1, which is the speed of sound. And that came, you know, that did happen, but it was a lot later, so they knew it was going a little, not going as fast as it should. But they got it to almost 3 minutes, and right before separation, they were supposed to separate to the second stage, and it just blew. And you can see this live on TV. But it's considered a success. You know, they don't get that far. These companies never get that far with the first launch. And they have another rocket ready to go. Once they work out the details of what happened, they'll make some changes, and they will try again. If it was successful, they would have had their first commercial launches by the end of the year. Right now, they had some CubeSats and things like that on board. It's going to be another company that will be able to put satellites into space. We have quite a few now. This Astra company, their fourth try, and they still haven't made it to orbit. They launched a couple weeks ago from Alaska, the Kodiak launch complex up in Alaska. But they might make it soon. They're running these pumps. You know, all these pumps have to spin like 100,000 RPM, and to do that, they use electric motors with lithium batteries, similar to what Rocket Lab is doing and has been doing successfully. They've launched almost 20 rockets so far from New Zealand, and soon they will be launching from the United States as well. One right after the other. It's getting almost impossible for me to follow all these launches, but this was pretty good. First launch, and the guy that was moderating the launch was very excited. He couldn't believe that they were doing as good as they did. And some of them don't even want, you know, any kind of media there. It's not a transparent situation. They kind of try to keep it as quiet as possible. Like Blue Origin did with their suborbital flights in the beginning. So it was a pretty... His website, if you could look at them, it's like before, during, and after is what I called it. They have the... what the rocket looks like with the name on the side of it at the launchpad in California. And then they show that as it's going up, beautiful launch. Everything was going on track, and then they showed the explosion as well. So it's three pictures that he put up. Let me just drop this. This is WS2S. Okay, let the Selden ID go. You guys listening to Glen Oaks probably didn't hear that. There are a lot of rockets that should be going up that aren't going up, but there is an oxygen shortage. And the main reason is because of COVID. There are thousands and thousands of people now in the hospital, especially throughout the South. Not so much up here, but in the South. We have plenty of ICU beds up here. I think last time I looked, it was 27% or something available, which is not bad. I mean, at one point, I think we had 32 or 33%. Go down south to Florida and places like that, and Alabama, Louisiana. You know, they're like down to zero. You know, I heard a couple of places were down to zero. So that means if you get sick down there and, you know, you need an ICU bed, they have to practically ship you out of, I guess, out of state. I don't know what they would do to you. They're all occupied with the COVID patients. All these COVID patients need oxygen. You know, that's the biggest problem. And it's not only in the United States. It's a worldwide problem. I remember when India was having a serious problem a few months ago. They kept showing us these people with all these oxygen tanks and trying to, you know, just to breathe. So oxygen is in short supply. That's not the only reason the rockets are having problems launching. Of course, they need, you know, oxygen, they use liquid oxygen, and they use a lot of it, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons, you know, just to do one launch. Some of the bigger rockets, naturally, they don't put in, you know, maybe 300,000 or 400,000 gallons of liquid oxygen like the SpaceX does with their new Starship. They haven't launched it in quite a while. But I think that's technical. They're trying to develop their rocket system. I don't think that's COVID or oxygen shortage related. But, you know, the companies that launch the rockets not only have, you know, a problem with the oxygen, they have problems with nitrogen. They use nitrogen to, you know, let's say to test the rocket before it goes up sometimes. Depending on the rocket, that's the way Firefly was. They have nitrogen spinning the pumps to start them up before ignition to get these things up to 100,000 RPM. So they'll use it for different reasons. So there actually is a nitrogen shortage getting to the launch complexes because they've taken a lot of trucks throughout the country that are normally supplying nitrogen and repurposing them for oxygen deliveries to send the trucks to, I guess, these remote hospital locations that need the oxygen. So that, you know, that is a nitrogen shortage and oxygen shortage, and either one is bad for the rocket industry. You know, they're still launching important, you know, like military missions, and, you know, they're not being delayed. I guess some of the other ones are, you know. Anyway, that's, Roy also put a picture of a big oxygen tank with half a dozen trucks sitting in front of it. You know, that could be a problem in the future. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, now one particular rocket is not having any kind of problem. They have enough oxygen to do what they got to do, and that's a Dragon crew vehicle that's going to be launched in actually 2 Sundays from now. That'll be happening during the day, probably before the net, so we'll be able to report on that, and I'm sure that will be on the news. This crew is all being paid by this one billionaire, Jared Isaacman. He's a billionaire that bought up 4 seats, paying Elon Musk to send all 4 people up. Seat is around $50 million, and when it comes to, like I said, $62 million before, yeah, that's to launch satellites, but to launch a crew is roughly around $50 million a seat, so it's a $200 million set of tickets that this guy really bought for this crew of four. Sean Proctor is a 50-year-old fellow from, he's got a pilot license. He's a science teacher somewhere. I forgot where. But another person going up is Haley. Haley is a 29-year-old physician. Assistant, she's PA. I always say it's good to have a doctor or something close to it. A couple of the doctors I've gone to are very good. I can't tell the difference between the two. I mean, they're very, they're just terrific. And it's good that they have one person that is capable of treating these people when they go off. This is the first time for all four of them. The other one is this Chris Zambosky. He's some kind of... The reason Haley was chosen, she was the physical assistant for the St. Jude Hospital. She had serious problems when she was younger with her legs and everything. And, when she got older, she found a doctor so much she actually became one. It should be pretty exciting. They named the base craft is called Resilience. The idea was to raise money for St. Jude Hospital. And St. Jude, they depend on donations. This billionaire thought that, well, we could have some kind of competition or some kind of an auction. He thought he was going to raise, $100 million or some ridiculous amount of money for St. Jude, which would have been great. I don't know. I think if he got 10% of that, I think he was lucky. It didn't work out. But anyway, he's still paying for these flights. Four people will be going up. And it's a trip to nowhere. It's a joyride to nowhere. They're not going to the International Space Station. It's been a little over 3 days in orbit. A little hot. For the space station, and the space station is around 250. They're heading up to the 300-mile range. SpaceX installed some kind of a globe, in the front of the Dragon spacecraft, on both now the crew vehicles and now the Dragon cargo vehicle as well. They have an ITER adapter, international. Together over the years, and that's how these new vehicles are actually docking with the space station. They no longer need the robotic arm, the 57-foot robotic arm, to grab it from nearby the space station and have it berthed to the space station, which is a much longer procedure. They go through a docking procedure, which means that at launch, basically anybody in on this crew, they really don't even have to touch a button from launch until they dock, until they would normally dock to a space station if they were doing that. But they're not, and which I still don't know why, but they're not going to the space station. They're just going to go in orbit and for 3 days and then come back down and land in the Atlantic Ocean. Anyway, where this docking system would normally be, Elon Musk had it all removed. They installed this globe. Well, it has to be 3 meter in diameter, flange all the way around, because that's how big the ITER, the International Docking Adapter system is. When they crawl through and go from the spacecraft into the space station, that's 3 foot in diameter. So that's what they, they need this globe to be that same diameter, and it's all apparently bolted down. I haven't seen the bolt pattern or anything on this, but I have seen a picture of the globe sticking out of the front of this thing. So when it goes to orbit, it launches on a Falcon 9 rocket, and the 9 rockets will, on the first stage, we'll get it up to orbit. First stage will come back down and land on the drone ship. Come back down and be reused. They've done that probably, about 80 times now that they've reused these rockets. The first stage. Second stage, that gets burnt up in the atmosphere. After releasing the cargo vehicle, or in this case, the crew vehicle, second stage will reignite and then force itself into the atmosphere to be burnt up. But the crew stage, the crew vehicle goes on normally to the International Space Station. This one's going to go into a 300-mile orbit, and have this globe. Now, you know, the front end of it, of the spacecraft, normally opens up. In this case, it will open up as well. It's hinged. It opens up, and that's what normally exposes the ITER adapter for docking. But this time, it's going to open up. This looks like a plexiglass dome. I hope it's very thick, you know, and I hope it's very well made and installed onto the Dragon crew vehicle. So they'll be able to float up inside and poke their head up and look around. You know, look at the stars, the moon, and the earth down below. And I guess four people will take turns doing that. They're going to sleep on board, spend 3 days in orbit, and then, like I said, eventually deorbit. You know, that hinged piece will eventually close up the globe, and then they'll be able to deorbit and eventually land in the Atlantic Ocean. That's definitely going to be on the news two Sundays from now. Any questions or comments? WS2X.
WB2BXL with a question.
Good evening, Frank. WB2BXL. WS2N, how are you?
Yeah, I happen to notice on Space YouTube, trying to remember what it is. Anyway, a couple of them, that it seems that Inspiration 4 sort of being rebranded as a health science mission rather than a joyride. The reason is partly because they're getting pushback about getting the crew astronaut wings for just taking a joyride. Anyway, I was wondering if you or Roy had any comments about the health science work they're reportedly doing on the mission. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know with Haley on board, you know, they'll be able to do that. But yeah, it started out as, you know, just, you know, four tickets to go to space. So if they're going to do science to justify getting the astronaut wings, yeah, I heard that's going to be most likely, I don't know if it is now, but most likely a new requirement. You know, you just won't be able to get into a spacecraft and go up and then do nothing and then just come. I've heard a couple of astronauts, one, Massimino, he's fine with what they did. He says anybody gets into space and comes back, they should be an astronaut. But I guess some people don't feel that way. But you asked Roy's opinion. I don't know. We'll go to Roy and see if he's familiar with us. I'm not even sure what medical stuff they're doing. See if he's heard anything about it. AC2GS, WS2F.
Yes, Paul. This is AC2GS. By the way, if you look at my link page, I put up a nice little photograph of the cupola of the Inspiration 4. It's an interesting view. It's kind of, you can look right down and see the hinge. So that will be interesting. To answer Frank's question, I am not aware of what scientific research. My assumption is that it won't be terribly useful, that they're getting the flack from a couple of billionaires who just went on a joyride recently and started to call themselves astronauts. So there's going to be a kickback on all those things. And people are going to have to rationalize why they went up there. So they'll do something. It probably took them about an hour and a half to come up with the idea, and it'll probably stay in everyone's consciousness for about the same amount of time.
Okay, yeah, I can see that being controversial. There's no, you know, I mean, they want. Let's see, I heard one group they wanted to. Space tourists, and yet, you know, if you were piloting the thing, then you get to be an astronaut. The shuttle took plenty of mission specialists up over the years, but they were always doing some kind of science, or they might do a spacewalk or something like that. So I guess they're going to throw a little extra something in there to qualify. But I know if I paid, you know, this guy's paying, what is it, $200 million for the four tickets. He better get an astronaut wing for that. I don't know. What are you going to do? I guess you could always get one on eBay. Any other comments? Frank, over to you.
That was kind of my take on it also. I know I didn't catch everything. I know they did do some experiments having to do with telomeres and some other thing about stuff like that. But I tend to agree, yeah, the primary reason for the experiments is probably so they can get recognition as astronauts. Anyway, so we'll see how useful the whole thing is. It's certainly different, and hopefully we'll get some positive attention for the various space programs going on. Anyway, I will be listening back to that WB2BXO.
Okay, thanks for that, Frank. And I hope, I hope Haley gets something. You know, she's, maybe they'll, sometimes they, you know, a common thing is blood tests. They actually do that a lot on the International Space Station. Maybe they'll do it on here as well. So if she pokes anybody with a needle or examines anybody, you know, I'm going to say that qualifies as doing something technical. Any data that comes back, whether it's used or not, it's still data. If they performed any experiments at all, if that's all that's required, outside of, you know, watching and coming back, I would say that's good enough to qualify as an astronaut, you know. And what's going to happen when, you know, Elon Musk is sending up hundreds of people at a time? You know, I think they're going to have, they will probably eventually give the passengers a different name, you know, space tourists or something. I would go with that. Any comments before I move on? This is WS2N.
KC2LR, can you hear me?
Quite clearly, Kay. Very, very good. AC2LR, WS2N.
Good evening. About 4 years ago, there was a group of high school students here on Long Island that won a competition amongst students across the nation to send a little experiment up to the International Space Station. And what they did was compare how seeds would grow. So they took identical seeds. I forget what plant it was, but they had the same soil, the same, you know, type of planter, and then they just sent an identical soil and seeds and a planter up to the International Space Station to see how they would compare to growing on Earth and growing in less gravity. It's pretty cool. I don't know what the results were, but they got recognized in Newsday, and I saw them give a little talk.
Oh, that's good. Those types of experiments ring a bell. That tells me they did a controlled science experiment. They grew something here on Earth and then had it germinate in space. I take it, you know, it was something along those lines. Back to you, Jack.
Exactly. They had identical seeds with identical soil. One and a identical size planter, I guess. And they had one in the space station gravity, or trying to grow there. I guess, I don't know how they float around. So they, and then one identical seeds growing here on Earth to compare.
Okay, very good. They used to have a 1 meter area set up in Columbus module, and that's expanded now. I think now it's 2 meter. Square meter. and that's where they're growing all these vegetables and, you know, experimenting. They've grown lettuce, and it's where they, when they experiment with a new product, new vegetable or whatever they're trying to grow, they don't eat it right away. They'll send it back on, we send it back on Dragon now, because Dragon's able to land in the water, and they'll take the experiments and look at them first, and then they'll give them the okay, and then they'll say to the astronauts, okay, you can eat whatever's up there. But they always do that first. You know, maybe these seeds from Long Island would have gone with that, maybe there were flowers or something. But, you know, I'll find out. If I think about it, I'll Google it, and I'm sure I can find it. Thanks for that, Kay. Any other comments?
Paul?
Yes, Roy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to relay, Kay is in the chat room. She asked, can someone tell Paul that my radio battery died? Thanks, and I'm still listening. So I just wanted to pass that on.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, I thought it was my radio that, you know, I heard my radio quit for in the beginning of the net a couple of times. I thought, okay, now I know it's the battery on Kay's radio. Very good. Well, Kay, thank you for that. And come back next week. As you know, we're here every week. Yeah, I wanted to mention Perseverance before it gets any later. Usually I talk about the helicopter that Perseverance brought up, but this time I'm talking about the holes that they're trying to drill, the core bore samples, is really what they want to get out of the rocks. All our probers, you know, the Spirit and Opportunity and
Complete.
Of course, Curiosity is still working on Mars. They drill holes, and, you know, and they actually have drill bits, and they drill holes, and they take the powder, and, you know, from the bits, and they'll analyze it in there. You know, they have chemistry labs on board those vehicles, and that's what they've done over the years. Now, Perseverance has a core boring that, you know, they'll actually drill into a surface of the Mars or rocks, mainly rocks, and they take that core bore sample, and they're going to put it into what looks like a test tube, the titanium test tube type thing. The whole gadget is designed to do that, and then eventually they'll be left on the surface of Mars, and eventually you're gonna have another rover go to Mars and drive over and pick these things up, bring them back to where that rover took off from, where it landed from, and then take off. Now we'll eventually be sent back to Earth. You'll eventually have all these samples, I think,